Welcome to the Michael Rivera What Really Happened radio show.
And aloha, America. Welcome to the show. It's Wednesday, hump day. We're halfway through the week heading for Pauhana Friday. And, you know, as usual, the news has been rather interesting on a number of fronts, and we're going to be getting into the economy pretty solidly today, not just to report the news that's going on, but to be very honest, I have, you know, as I'm sure all of you have, been putting a great deal of thought into the economy and what's going on, what it might take to fix it, if it's possible to fix it, and who might actually be thinking that it's in their own interest to let it all fall apart. Now, the Dow was kind of bouncing around a lot today. It ended up 172 points. This despite the fact that all the indicators are down, all the economic news was pretty much negative. And I think the consensus of opinion at this point, since the election is over, that the plunge protection team is keeping the Dow in the 8,000s, not letting it go any further down, in the hopes that this will encourage people to go out and spend more for their holiday shopping. And those numbers are looking terrible right now, I might add. But I think there might also be a little bit of ego and vanity going on here, and I cannot help but wonder if the plunge protection team is keeping the Dow from dropping any further than it has so that George Bush can leave office next month and sort of convince himself that the economy may not have been great, but at least it was okay when he left office. And I'm sure the sincere hope of the GOP as a whole is that the real scale of the economic disaster will manifest itself with a Democratic president in the White House and a Democratic Congress, and that they can go into the 2010 and 2012 campaign seasons arguing about how the Democrats wrecked the economy. But I think at this point it's pretty obvious the economy is well and truly wrecked. And we can't even really say it was any one administration, although certainly the last 8 years accelerated the deterioration. But the reasons for the economy and our decline go back really quite a bit further, and they go back really almost 30 years. And we've gone over that time and time again, and I'm not going to go into that part about it today. We've got some new things to talk about. And if you'd like to join us on the air, the number is 800-259-9231, 800-259-9231. Start off with a couple of little headlines here. Pilgrim's Pride has gone under, a poultry manufacturing company. Chrysler and GM are reporting their sales are now down 40%. I think the news of their request for a bailout is working against them. People don't want to buy a car if the company that makes it is going to go out of business and parts will become scarce. So that's a big issue. So, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, has already distributed $179 billion to the largest financial institutions in the United States. The first $125 billion was forced on the nine largest financial institutions by Henry Paulson on October 28th. Now, literally, they weren't asking for it at the time, but now everybody is lining up. They're coming up with any excuse to say, we need a piece of that action, and Paulson has gone through the original allotment of that $700 billion, and as you heard on the last news break, probably by next week he is going to go back to Congress and say, I need the rest of the money. And remember, originally he said he was going to leave this money for Barack Obama to have available to deal with the economic difficulties. That, too, has changed. Now, as I pointed out a couple of weeks ago and was validated by an article in the New York Times just yesterday, the fact that Paulson keeps changing his mind about what he wants to do with the money really underscores that there wasn't really a coherent plan involved in that request for the money. They're just taking money and throwing it wherever they think it's going to actually help. That really is all that government can do, besides declare war on something, is take money from one group and put it to another group. And they're doing it in the hope that they can somehow bail the economy out of its problems. But if you're in a boat and there's a hole in it and water is coming in and you take a little bucket and you pick up the water from the bow section and you just pour it into the stern section, over and over and over again, you're not going to keep the boat from sinking. And yet this is basically what Paulson and everybody else are doing. They're just taking the money and moving it around. And they're not addressing the issue that the only way we can get out of the nation's financial difficulty is for new money to be coming in. But there's no magic way to make that happen immediately. And, you know, that's why they're just, they're trying to justify their positions and their jobs and everything by just saying, oh, yes, we can fix it. We're going to take $700 billion away from the American taxpayer and give it to the banks so the banks can loan it right back to the American taxpayer at interest. This is their idea of a solution. The problem is that none of this stuff is working yet. Basically, TARP has failed. Now we've got the automakers are up here asking for money. Cities are starting to ask for money. California is asking for money. They all want a piece of, you know, the largesse coming out of the government. But the problem is that it's just moving the debt and the money around, and it's not dealing with the issue of total solvency. And so TARP really isn't working. It's just an excuse to take a bunch of money and throw it at people's friends. Now, over at the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke has almost doubled the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve. They're just loaning money out left and right. And remember, when they were talking about a rescue plan in front of Congress, they were talking about transparency and oversight and openness. And here we have trillions of dollars has gone out from the Federal Reserve, and Bernanke is refusing to name many of the financial institutions who got the money. He will not even mention the collateral that they've put up for those loans. And as I mentioned on an earlier show, this is very reminiscent of some of the abuses we saw during the SNL bailout in the 80s that just turned into a grand looting of the public treasury that has never really been dealt with. So, you know, what does it mean for the American people? You know, we're all under intense stress. You heard on the last news break, you know, people dealing with anxieties and stress-related disorders is skyrocketing, and you know, there's no support and help for them. Everybody's out of equity. They can't borrow against their houses. And since they don't have the jobs, they're starting to live on their credit cards. And this is leading to another huge default situation on the credit cards. And that's going to be the next big explosion to the banking system. And sure enough, the banks are going to say, well, we need a taxpayer bailout to deal with all of this issue. And I think the short version of this is that we're in the loot the nation stage. I don't think the government can fix the economy. I don't think they can turn it around except by just one means, and that would be to cut taxes 50% across the board immediately, and the economy would start to revive. Of course, they won't do that because the government owes too much money to their various creditors, including the Federal Reserve, who are not feeling generous enough to let them off the hook. And the U.S. has run out of credit lines that they can move the debt onto, and they're trying to find a way to pay it all off. And the problem is that the generation of wealth comes from the working class, manufacturing jobs, and we let all that stuff go. It's just kind of flown away. So, thinking this whole thing through to the inevitable end, I've come to the conclusion the economy cannot be saved. Absent the immediate cutting of all taxes by 50% or the complete abdication of the current federal government with its debts so that we can start over with a government that's relatively debt-free and hopefully has a little more fiscal sense. So we're going to take a break here for some commercials. We're going to come back, and I'm going to explain to you why, under the present circumstances, the economy is unsalvageable, why our political leaders probably realize it's unsalvageable, and how they may be setting us up for the biggest swindle in all of history. We'll be back after these words from sponsors.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Well, search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Fear and hate will rule them, said the demon grow. In shackles we will bind them, to the terror they'll be shown. As mindless slaves they will not think, blind eyes they will not see. They'll jail themselves and call the bars Homeland Security.
Aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. We've got callers on the line, but before we get to them, I want to finish up this thought from the first segment. Why the economy cannot be fixed using the methods that the government is doing now, which is to borrow money, throw it at various corporations, and then hope it all works out down the road. And by the way, the consensus of expert opinion is that all of these bailouts are not going to work in the long run. And here is why. Take notes. There's a quiz next period. Every product that is made in the United States and sold, whether it's domestic or foreign, includes within its price tag the accumulated taxes of everybody and every institution and every company that was involved in its manufacturing and distribution and sales. Every employee who is paid, they're subject to withholding, that money that is sent to the government becomes part of the calculation of the price of the object, or the product, or the goods, or the services. The taxes paid on the buildings get factored in as part of the cost of the product. And the bottom line is, the higher the taxing structure, the more expensive products are going to be. At a rough estimate, when you walk into your supermarket and you pull something off that shelf, one-third of that price that you are seeing on that product is the accumulation of taxes of everybody along the chain of creation, packaging, shipping, retail. One-third of the price are the taxes, and that's before you pay the sales tax on it. Here in Hawaii, it's a little bit higher because we have an excise tax that is applied at every step of the process. When it comes off the boat, the excise is applied. When it goes from the shipping people to the wholesalers, the excise is applied again. When it goes to the retailers, it's applied again. And when it's sold out the door to us, it's applied again. So it's a huge, huge uplift in our case. So here's what we have. Because of the tax structures, and we pay very high taxes relative to the rest of the world, we have some of the highest corporate taxes in the world. When you add up all the various little taxes that we are paying, not just income tax, but all the little fees and excises and everything, you know, the U.S. government makes more money off of your work than you do, between the employee taxes that are paid on your behalf, and it really is a nightmare out there. And as those taxes go up, as they tend to do, that correspondingly drives up the price of American goods and services and products. And here is the problem. As those prices have been driven up by taxation to deal with the government's debt that has been building up over the last 50, 60 years, American corporations will value engineer their products. It's a very polite term for making them cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. This is where this pressure to put melamine in food comes from, because it's less expensive when it gets past the inspection. Just all these little shortcuts that go on, where companies that used to make really good, high-quality products, now they're making stuff that's just barely holding together, because that's the only way they can keep the price low enough to remain competitive on the global market. And so far from being this leading manufacturing power of 30, 40 years ago, where we made the very best of many things in the world, American products today have a reputation of being overexpensive and of very poor quality, and sometimes sort of bloated out, and less than elegant and less than wonderful is the short version. So what do we have here? We have a government whose only solution to the economic crisis is to start borrowing more money and throwing it at corporations, which means inevitably somebody somewhere in our society is going to have to pay more taxes, whether it is the working people paying more income tax, or corporate executives paying more taxes, or the corporations themselves paying more taxes, or property taxes are going to be going up because the states are running out of money. And as those prices and those taxes go up, the prices of the goods and products will go up with them. And so we've got this double whammy working against the American products. It's not only more expensive, it's still low quality. And even the fact that the dollar itself is actually in decline is not going to be enough to really offset that, unless the dollar does a major total collapse where it's only worth 10 cents of what it was worth before. Then we might start attracting some customers for our less than wonderful products. But the bottom line is borrowing more money and inevitably leading to higher taxes is just going to strangle our productivity even further. The very best thing the government could do to revive the economy is to get out of our way. Let us keep more of our money so we can pay off our credit cards and our mortgages and our car loans. Let us keep more of our money so we can put them back into our business, so we can do the extra advertising to attract more customers. The government says it's trying to help us and do everything in the world possible to improve the economy, but it won't do the one thing that would really work, and that is to cut taxes by 50% across the board. Yes, we'd have to give up killing Middle Eastern people, but I, for one, am willing to make that sacrifice to save the economy of this country. We're going to go to the phones. We've got Dan in New Hampshire. Dan, aloha. What's on your mind?
Hi, Michael. Thank you for your
aloha.
Work. Hang on. Let me get you off of... There we go. Head Jen, speakerphone. I'm surprised that you know, you're not bringing up the same one of the solutions. I agree with one of the your solution of reducing taxes, but I think that we ought to go a little further than 50%. I think that we ought to pay the taxes that the law states that we are liable for, and that's basically for most of us zero. But beyond that, what the only reason that we're paying income taxes is to pay the debt on our debt-based money. And the debt-based money is the problem. It is the big robber baron of the age of almost 100 years since the Federal Reserve was put into effect, but there were previous central banks that were doing the same thing. And Ron Paul and a lot of us out here, we think that that they ought to take the, 400 and some million dollar option and buy out the Fed and send the private bankers packing for their thievery and double dealing.
Like Andrew Jackson did.
Well, yeah.
Jackson did.
Yeah.
Now, I'm in agreement with you. That's going to be a hard sell right now, as is simply going back to the idea that the income tax is actually illegal. Because if you go back to Sullivan versus United States, Judge James C. Fox admits right in the case record that the 16th Amendment wasn't really ratified. But then he says, you know, we've been getting away with it for so long, we really shouldn't change it or can't change it. So my idea of picking 50% is because that's the defense allocation. And it's really very hard for the government to convince us that we should be paying twice as much taxes so we can go over and bomb a bunch of people in the Middle East, especially given that they didn't really have weapons of mass destruction and didn't do 9/11 and weren't really aiding al-Qaeda.
Not to mention the hundreds of bases that we're supporting all over the world that we don't need to be.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like the old Roman Empire.
These are all the solutions that Ron Paul was promoting.
I wanted Ron Paul, and I'm sorry that he didn't get in there. Dan, we got to let you go. We got to take a real break here, a short break here. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors. Thank you for the call, Dan.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Call Mike now at 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. We're going to go right back to the phones there. We have got Drew on the line from California. Aloha, Drew. What's on your mind today?
Not too much, Mike. Pleasure to talk to you finally. Been listening to you for a while, and I was kind of curious. A comment that you had made on Monday in reference to Obama nominating Hillary Clinton as his Secretary of State in that Article 1, Section 6, Clause 2, explicitly forbids sitting senators or representatives from appointments to office that have been created or have the salaries increased during their term in either house.
Mm-hmm.
And you had said something to the effect of that it seemed odd that they had missed that, or something to that effect. I don't know, maybe it's a matter of...
Well, what I actually said was it was an indicator that they're just not paying attention anymore. That, you know, we have seen, you know, Bush with his blankety-blank piece of paper. You know, certainly the way the $700 billion bailout was passed through Congress, that was unconstitutional.
Well,
it just seems like we've reached that stage where they wave the Constitution at us for vestigial ritual reasons, but really don't pay that much attention to it anymore.
Yeah, don't read it. If you have it, you're a domestic terrorist.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, it's like we've crossed over into the Twilight Zone, but it was kind of interesting when I heard you say that, because not to argue on one side or the other of it, but when the callers were coming in and saying, oh, no, really, Obama's not really a U.S. citizen, there's no birth certificate, whatever it was, the logic of the argument that you had presented was that it would be ridiculous to suggest that the Democratic Party would miss that, and yet here mm-hmm. we are seeing that now, of course. And like I said, it's a matter of perspective, that I see them pretty much all as criminals who are going to behave like criminals, and sure enough, they're breaking any law they think they can get away with.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I see your point, and, you know, what we are hearing is supposedly that this matter is going to go before the United States Supreme Court, and I'm going to reserve any further judgment on the matter until they look at it. You know, there's obviously a lot of evidence on one side. There's a lot of implications coming from the other side. And basically, my concern here is that if the Supreme Court, and this is separate from the issue of whether Obama is or is not a natural-born citizen. I want to put that down as a separate issue. If the Supreme Court were to intervene and say that Obama is not eligible to be president, two things would happen, I think. First of all, George Bush would have his constitutional crisis because, you know, obviously Joe Biden would not be vice president without Barack Obama being the lead candidate. So who is supposed to take over in January? Second, I think if the U.S. government found some mechanism by which they could justify preventing Barack Obama from taking office in January, that we would have race riots across the country. And then again, you have the national emergency that George Bush can use to declare martial law. So I'm wondering why this has remained an issue even after the election, and I'm concerned that we are being set up for some kind of a manufactured domestic emergency that would allow George Bush to impose the FEMA laws and a draconian national emergency rule. I mean, we already know they've got American soldiers in the streets with the troops. They've got all this equipment ready to go. They've been preparing for major civil uprisings for a long, long time. They may just decide, let's kick one off now and get it over with and bring about the New World Order or whatever they're going to call it.
Well, certainly. I mean, I would take the step beyond the whole, you know, race riots and simply say if they twice in 10 years were to blatantly and openly reverse the will of the people, I think, I mean, certainly not just, you know, not just one group or another, but when people realize that the sham of democracy had completely fallen away, that they would feel less compelled to obey people who openly didn't represent them.
Well, you know, we had that situation. I mean, the courts in Ohio did confirm that at least in 2004, Kerry should have won. And so I'm wondering why we, the American people, are on the financial hook for everything that happened during the second 4 years of Bush's administration, given that he can't prove he's legally the president.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, the same thing could be said about 2000 with Florida and the 250,000 people who were denied the right to vote and have their votes mm-hmm. counted because they were black and poor and Hispanic and whatever else. Some people with felony convictions listed for the 2000 election, their criminal records listed convictions in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
So either Minority Report was really just here's how we do it, or they really have, really have just gone off the deep end in terms of making things up.
Well, I think definitely the latter circumstance. But, you know, I'm very concerned that if something comes out of this whole birth certificate issue and the Supreme Court does intervene and, you know, the Electoral College or the Supreme Court reverses the results of the election. You know,
yes.
If Barack Obama is forced to step down and Biden with him, that puts Hillary Clinton one life away from the White House.
Yeah, and I think that's really kind of a remote
I'd be very nervous if I were Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a remote possibility because I think that, I mean, while I definitely agree that there are elements of, you know, as you've said, accident, greed, and stupidity involved in this, I mean, they're certainly not all-powerful and all-knowing. But I think it would be, I mean, the absolute definition of insanity to take a risk that big and you know, give up the salesmanship, so to say, of convincing us that really we matter and, you know, that really we, you know, we live in a free and open democracy and the rule of law applies. If they really openly just started saying, yeah, we're going to do whatever we want in language that, you know, that the population isn't too dumb to understand.
Well, we've been in this very, very fragile area, and I think the majority of Americans don't believe that we're a fair and honest and truthful and just society. In fact, I think there was a poll to that very effect not too long ago. But the way the government avoids a revolution is to never do something so overt and obvious that people feel morally obligated to respond. I think if this thing with Barack Obama and his birth certificate, if something were to actually come out of that, I think it would definitely provoke a very strong reaction. And you're right. It wouldn't just be the black people rioting. You know, there'd be a lot of the rest of us would be down there saying, yeah, you know, now's the time. Look what happened in Iceland. Look what's happening in Thailand. Now it's starting to happen in Zimbabwe. This could be a global revolutionary phenomenon we're beginning to see the start of.
Yeah. Well, certainly. I mean, in one form or another, it already is a global revolutionary phenomenon in that, you know, not so much that people are out shooting in the streets, but people are starting to reevaluate how things are done.
Mm-hmm.
And how when you boil it all down, really it's quite ridiculous that it's all based on a three-card money game. You know?
Yeah,
real
it
value
really
here.
Is.
Wait, no, it's there. No, it's really here.
Well, you know, it's interesting because in The Art of War, Sun Tzu puts that all wars are based on deception, and I would take that one further, and I'd say that all government is based on deception. Government runs like a religion. It depends on the blind faith of the masses to support it and not ask any questions. And, you know, especially since we all learned we were lied to about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, we're not in a position to trust the government anymore. I mean, they're just taking all this money. They're sticking us with the bill. The bailout, as it stands right now, the total promised obligations, $8.3 trillion, that's $100,000 per American household added to our tax burden for which we will get no additional goods, services, or infrastructure.
Well, certainly, but in the disconnected from reality world that these people live in, we've all got that in our pockets.
Yeah, that's where it's really going to fail. They think we've got it. We don't. All right, we got to take a break here. And, Drew, thanks an awful lot for the phone call. We're going to let you go here, but please call in again. You're absolutely right, though. It's a crazy situation out there, and I think they're courting disaster. But, you know, these people are desperate. They can't save the economy. They either got to start a war or they got to start a civil war inside this country. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors. Welcome back to the show. It's the last segment of our show today. I'm going to pick up a couple of loose ends here. We're just now getting word of a magnitude 6.2 earthquake near Honshu. We've not gotten any kind of a heads up about potential tsunami activity. So if you're living around the Pacific Rim, just keep an eye on your favorite resource for that. On this day in history, Illinois became the 21st state of the United States. Oberlin College in Ohio became the first co-ed institution of higher learning in the United States in 1833. And on this date in 1967, Dr. Christian Barnard performed the world's first human heart transplant. So little bits of history. Now, turning to more recent events, America's, because of the economy and stresses and concern over collapsing government, possible attempts to establish a dictatorship, America is definitely turning back towards survivalism. And I remember back in the 80s and 90s, people who were survivalists, who wanted to make sure that they could survive for at least a reasonable interval of time, self-sustained, without needing supermarkets or power grid or city water or anything, were looked on kind of askance. The media would make fun of them, you know, oh, those sillies, they're living back in a cabin in the woods and, you know, acting like civilization is on the verge of fall and everything. And people who were like, you know, and I'm not talking even the extreme ones, just people who keep food in their home, extra food in their homes and, you know, big jugs of water and all this other stuff. You know, there's a lot of ridicule and everything going on. And now all of a sudden it's the new hot thing. They're reporting all across the country, Americans are stocking up on canned foods. And, you know, the old joke, canned foods and shotguns. It's not a joke anymore. People are buying firearms. And, you know, partly it is because during times of hard economic pressures, crime is going to go up. And people want to be able to protect themselves. But there's also the aspect, a lot of people think that Barack Obama is going to enact some major anti-gun legislation. And, excuse me. But another part of it is just Americans realizing that if there is a major social upheaval, if the economy does collapse and the U.S. government goes the way of the Soviet Union, that people are going to have to be prepared to go for a few weeks' time entirely self-contained on their own. And I don't think it's such an extreme point of view, because it's just common sense. If you live someplace where hurricanes are a regular fact of life, you want to have extra food, water, flashlights, first aid kits, battery-operated or crank-operated radio. That just makes common sense. The same thing if you live where tornadoes occur, or if you're in Los Angeles, where the, you know, big earthquakes hit. When my wife and I went through the Northridge earthquake, it literally destroyed our refrigerator and kitchen. But we had a case of MREs in our earthquake kit that got us through until the local supermarket was able to open their doors and start trade again. So nobody questions you when you're preparing for a hurricane or an earthquake or a tornado or big storms or anything like this. So they really shouldn't be that critical of anybody who wants to prepare for a possible disruption of civil society, because it's looking more and more like that may actually happen. And they're looking at that. They're taking it seriously that the government could fall out of its own corruption and bankruptcy. And on its way out, as our last caller said, on its way out, it may take some desperate chances to try and cling to power and preserve its own life. One thing you need to remember about governments: when they are in trouble, when they see their own reign of power threatened, it's very easy for them to confuse their own welfare and their own benefit for the good of the nation as a whole. And that's when some of the worst abuses are going to show up. So, anyway, moving right along here, interesting little bit of history showed up. More of the Nixon tapes have been released. These are now, for those of you who are not old enough to remember, Richard Nixon was forced to resign from the presidency over a scandal involving cover-up of a break-in at the Watergate Hotel, specifically the Democratic National Committee headquarters. And what really blew the case open was the revelation that Richard Nixon was tape recording all the conversations in his office. And there was a big legal battle over the tapes. And some of them were released, a lot of them were transcribed in order to take out the profanity, which Nixon was very capable of when he was under stress or hitting the turkey nip. And I know that one from first-person direct experience. So those tapes were released. Nixon was facing impeachment, and he resigned. Well, now we're all these years later, and they're beginning to release more and more of these tapes, and they reveal a man quite different from the carefully crafted public image of a political campaign. And just a very vain, cynical, at times paranoid individual who was not at all hesitant to abuse the authority of his office to go after his enemies, in particular the Brookings Institute. And at one point on one of the tapes, he talks about emptying the Brookings Institute of certain critical key files and framing a third party for it. And I bring this up not because it's time to go back and bash Richard Milhouse Nixon. It's a reminder that politicians spend a great deal of money and time and effort crafting a public image for consumption in the major media. And they can be very, very different. And unfortunately, we're beginning to see that certainly with Barack Obama, who has a wonderful persona and talks about change during his whole campaign. And now that he's won the election, it's basically Bill Clinton light going into the White House with all of the old same Clinton cronies. And I was hoping we would finally be free of the Bush-Clinton duopoly that has cursed our nation for close to a quarter of a century. But it looks like we're still going to go on with a lot of the old Clinton cronies. And word of advice to the Deputy White House Counsel, don't follow the blonde into that basement room, okay? And you all know what I'm talking about. Now, this one is really going to upset a lot of people. You probably remember from a week ago, there were grand jury indictments handed down against Vice President Dick Cheney and former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez regarding these private prison corporations and the abuses that went on in them, and basically covering up the fact that these abuses were happening. Dick Cheney was indicted because of his financial connections to this institution, and there was an arraignment to which the prosecutor did not show up. Originally, people were wondering if something had happened to him. It turned out he had not been informed of when the arraignment was going to be and was out of position. They came back to do another arraignment. There had been a motion against the judge to dismiss himself from the case because of connections to the accused, and he managed to get past that and then promptly dismissed all the indictments. So the case is over. It is dead. It is gone. And unfortunately, that's where we are. We thought the system was going to finally exact justice for some of the crimes that we've seen. And what we see is the system taking care of itself and preserving itself. Now, final little piece of news here. And again, this is probably not going to come as a surprise to too many people. Cluster bombs are one of the worst weapons that are out there right now, short of nuclear or chemical biological weapons. Cluster bombs are basically a lot of little bombs inside a big case. They're released from an airplane. They fall down. They spread out over a wide area. It's like a giant shotgun shell. They're very, very lethal. And the real danger with them is that the cluster bomblets, the little tiny individual munitions, don't always explode on contact. And they stay on the ground as a de facto landmine. During the invasion of Afghanistan, the little bomblets were painted yellow and stamped with a typeface that looked identical to the emergency food ration packets that were being dropped on the ground. So Afghanis would pick them up, they'd blow up, tear their hand off. It was a repeat of what the Russians used to do. Okay, the music means end of the show. We will be back tomorrow, Thursday, with more news, more phone calls. Until then, stay safe, be well. Aloha, America.